We're here for the caching overview and also the handling large session and reference data pattern. We're going to show you the two slides again for the benefit of the people on the video. So if you want to get 23% off before September 17th, use this code here, argpatterns23. And the specific chapter from the book that we're covering this afternoon is chapter 18. Just to show you where we are and see that we're in the final stretch now and there's not that much longer you need to stay with us. We're here, it's 1:15. I'm conscious that you've all been sitting down for quite a while, so we're going to give you a break after this session for 15 minutes. Then you will have Stephen up here again doing remote message broadcast, and then we'll have complex event processing. So that, oh, you want a break after Stephen's? Okay, cool. Sorry, so the break will actually be at 2:30. And then Richard has the final session of the day on complex event processing, which should be really good. So what we're looking at today then is a scenario where we ended up using AppFabric Cache. And this is an online gaming company. I've worked with a number of these companies in the past during my time at Microsoft. And there's numerous of them around. You know, the type of company where you can play online blackjack, poker, etc. This is an interactive online gaming company. They have games from tic-tac-toe to blackjack. They have access to a social networking feed. They have news feeds, personals. They can modify their portal page. Basically, anything that the company can do to encourage them to play more and spend more money, they will do. They can play against other users or against the WinGuru system, and with some of the games where there's no money at risk, they can actually pause and log out. And the company introduced this feature in order to increase the user stickiness. What we see often with these companies is that most of them began like in the mid to late 90s. And many of them actually out of the dot-com boom, actually the amount of traffic that they had grew exponentially. A few of the colleagues in my team have worked with a number of these customers, and what we see is we see a similar pattern. What we see is where they've made the decision to trade money. You can't hear me? Is that better? Oh. It's lower? Okay. Is it okay now or not? Okay, anyway, so what we see with these customers is that most of the time they make a choice when they look at buying their technology where they trade money for time. So what I mean is if they have a storage problem, they have so many more users coming onto the site and they're spending so much money, the amount of revenues that these companies can get is really, really huge, that quite correctly for them, they often make the decision that I'll buy a faster storage. And then you know, fast forward 3 months, 6 months, 1 year later, they need more processing capability, we'll buy a bigger server. And you can see that the similar decisions come on and keep going. And what we often find is that eventually at a certain point, they reach a point where they can't buy themselves out of trouble, right? They can't buy that extra performance. And what's happened is that the system has grown organically. And I guess we could say that this doesn't just apply to like an online gaming company. It applies to any company that has a very explosive growth. If you look at a company like MySpace, for instance, they originally started off with no caching solution, right? Everything was going to the database. And eventually, when the explosion of users happened, they realized that they were going to have to implement some type of a caching solution. So I know that many of you and your customers, you know, you may have a site where actually I don't need to use caching today, and you're probably right, you may not. But having a think about how I can plan this in for the longer term and how I can use it and being aware of the scenarios is really what we want to accomplish today, so that you can think about in the future, is there a way in which I could use this and how would I actually go about building that in? So the technology platforms that this customer has is primarily Windows Platform, ASP.NET Web Tier, Custom.NET applications. Fraud detection is a huge part of the investment of developer time that these type of companies actually make, and quite rightly so, right? There are literally people's money at stake. So they tend to have a small number of very bright people who will do a lot of data mining, complex data analysis, looking for trending. And in some cases, what they'll actually do is they'll have a single state server where every single action comes from a single increasing ID. So if Michael makes a move, that's move number one. I make a move, like on the poker table, that's move number two. And if they detect a fraud, sometimes they'll actually be able to rewind to that point in time. So all of the transactions after they've detected a fraud or some type of suspicious activity. So the amount of things that go on in the background is really quite interesting, you know, as a technology person to go speak to them. The backend data store is SQL Server. And the SQL Server has grown organically over time. They've decided to have lots of different file groups. File groups were added for different reasons. They had previous storage where they had individual file group on an individual set of LUNs. And now they've moved to a shared everything model. So when I say shared everything model, I'm referring to their storage. So there are two main principles that people can follow when they do like a stan storage or a direct attached storage. You can either dedicate specific disks to the log drive, to the data drive, to all of these things, right? So you may say, I need to do 200 IOPS per second, so I'm going to do a RAID 1 pair. I know a single disk can do about 200 IOPS per second. Eventually, over time, you may find that it becomes very complex to actually keep track of all of these things. So what a lot of people have done, and what a lot of SAN vendors actually recommend, is that people go for a shared everything model. So you buy, you know, a SAN storage, and you have 200 disks in there, you know, mostly fiber channel, so they're all reasonably fast. You put a large amount of cache in the array, and you share everything across there. Now, what we've often found when working with customers is that the file group structure that they had when they had dedicated individual disks may not map well, you know, to this type of a scenario. So I'm just trying to give you a background of some of the issues and some of the challenges that I've seen, you know, when it comes to this type of a scenario. So the requirements that they gave us, they wanted to reduce end user response times. There's a direct correlation in this type of scenario between if my users get a faster, better, more reliable experience, then they will spend more money with me and I will make more money in return. So reducing end user response time is key here. Provide a scale factor, and so architect the solution so that it can scale for increased growth of the company. Now, everyone wants linear scale, right? Everybody wants, you know, if I add one more server, I want a 2x performance. Unfortunately, things don't actually work like that in technology, so a more realistic curve, and something that we aim for when we're working with customers and we aim internally in our products, is at least a curve of 1.6, right? So 1.6 is the minimum scaling factor we'll accept for any component. Store the data in two places at all times. So that came from what they said was implement high availability, and then minimize the impact on mission critical systems by offloading temporal data access to medium end servers. So what we're really saying in this, the requirement that we've derived, is we want to reduce access to the database for a read-only content. So the other facts that they gave us, commodity enterprise hardware is used for non-mission critical workloads. The way I interpret that is the solution, whichever we decide to follow, must support everything from a commodity server with 1, 2, 4 or 8 CPUs all the way up to something with 32, 64 CPUs, more like we'd see in an enterprise. We need to have some type of a security and manageability features, as I've talked about in my other sessions. That's almost always there as a requirement. And when users connect to the website, if that particular web server goes down, they don't want that to impact the actual user's experience. And then finally, the customer is really looking to design all components so that they're self-contained, so they're pluggable instead of taking a hard dependency. That's kind of like some panacea vision often, but it's a general principle that they want to follow. They want their architecture to be pluggable so that they can pull features in and out over time. That's a really interesting one. It's often one that we hear when we have customers who we work with, especially people writing applications. They often want to write the application so it can sit on SQL Server and it can sit on Oracle and other databases. I think it's really important to drill down into what's the reason for this requirement and how much effort will it be, because sometimes in those cases we can actually find that having not taking a dependency on any specific platform means that I'm actually not optimized for any of them, right? So it is worth, when I hear things like that, it's worth drilling in and understanding really what does the customer actually want, what does the partner actually want, and what are the reasons behind this. So as I've said before, this slide's really for the benefit of the people on the video who haven't seen this before. Tracking the individual requirements is really hard. Certainly for me, if someone tells me like 15 things, I either have to write them down, I can't keep track of them. Someone, we went on a training recently internally in Microsoft, and they said that people can remember roughly 7 plus or minus 2 things. So I try and keep my things down to like, you know, 5 to 9 scenarios for any given project that I'm working on, and really look at the scenarios that we need to support when I'm working and actually working with a customer to develop a solution. So the scenario that we've derived from this, first of all, is the session state, right? So when the user logs into the site, there was a key requirement that when they log in, they don't want to have to do the sticky routing. If we look at the traditional ASP.NET state management, and you'll see this lovely diagram, you can see that the session data is stored on an individual server. Well, what that actually means is if that individual server actually fails, now suddenly the user loses his session, right? So he has to log in, he has to start again. I'm sure many of you experience this when you're logging online and you log out, you've ordered something from a site, you get partway through the order, you spend 15 minutes ordering it, choosing it, adding all the additional items, and then you lose your session, right? It happens less and less now, because a lot of sites have tweaked onto this, but when it does happen, it's really actually annoying. And most of the time, I won't go back to those sites. So in that scenario, where did my shopping cart, really, where did my data about my session, the things that I'm doing on this website, where did it actually go? We've got two options. We either leave it on this single server dependency, or we can use a SQL session state provider. So that's okay, SQL is durable, multiple machines can access it, but really now we're putting excess load on the database, which is costing us a lot of money to maintain, and that may introduce other problems on SQL Server going forward, depending on the number of users that we have. Also, really, SQL Server has a lot of ACID, transactional capabilities when you read data from it, insert data from it into it, etc. And really, you're taking all of that overhead where you may not necessarily need it, right? You really need all of those durability requirements in this scenario. So here, the database becomes hot. So this scenario number 2 was then provide scalable performance as the traffic increases by 6x. So often application objects in these social networking sites or gaming sites where they're providing feeds from lots of different people, they're really constructed from combining data from different sources. So for instance, every time the user logs in, we may need to access the following tables, like list of posts, post-related threads, and the user response. These could be the tables that we have for some type of forum feature on the site, right, where people can discuss things. And we may want to load up on the screen, hey, your buddy has replied to that thread, etc. In order to do that, we may need to do more than one stored procedure or, actual execute some SQL. Now, initially, when you're dealing with a site, what will happen is that if you buy a server and you follow this approach where you trade, money for time, and you buy more and more memory for your SQL server, you actually have an implicit cache, right? The implicit cache is actually called the buffer pool. If you're doing a read from memory, or even if you're doing a write, the read will always just come from the buffer pool pages in memory, and the write, we won't actually commit the data page, we'll only actually commit to the actual transaction log. And if you have a really expensive SAN, then we're only actually writing to the cache. So the response time that you get on a write may be like in the order of like 1 millisecond, and a read may be like a 1 millisecond. Quick tip for you, if you're looking at like the read and write, the average the logical disk counters, average disk second a read and average disk second a write, if you see that for the data drive within SQL where all your MDF and NDF files are, if you're taking like 1 or 2 milliseconds to actually read from that, you're not actually going to the disk. You're always going to the buffer pool. And you'll have heard me and Michael talk about that. And the difference between that and going to DISC, you know, a few months ago, those of you that were here at the talk. Now, when we think about it, so let's say that we start off and we're a site, and let's say for every user, let's take an average, let's say we have 1 megabyte of data, just as an argument. So when we have 1,000 users, now we have, you know, 1 gigabyte of data. When we have 10,000 users, now I have 10 gigabytes of data. When I have 100,000 users, I have 100 gigabytes of data. And now let's say that 10% of those are in use, right, at any one point in time. Now, if I have 100,000 users and only 10,000 of them are logged in at any one point in time, that means that my current working set that I need to access is probably going to be in the order of magnitude of about 10 gigabytes, right? Well, I can buy 10 gigabytes on eBay or Amazon.com right now, right? And it's, you know, we can buy it on a credit card. But if we have 1 million users or 10 million users and we need terabytes of memory, that becomes different. So you can see that now actually we're actually getting a much worse performance, and the curve will go off like this in terms of the site performance. So it will go from being really, really, really good to actually being really, really, really bad, because you're actually, you were never accessing the disk in the first place, and now you're accessing the disk all of the time. So now you're getting more like 8 to 10 milliseconds, more like 7 to 10 milliseconds anyway for every read and write that you're doing at the best case, right? If your disks are not configured correctly and all of those things, suddenly I've seen it where I've had customers 50, 60, 70 milliseconds to read. And if you now, say for instance, you wanted to do replication, you want to replicate that data between sites, that's another common thing. That may add another, you know, best case scenario replication, synchronous replication between two sites with dark fiber will add about a 4 millisecond overhead. But if you've got other issues and your service processors on your storage can't keep up, it may be more like 10 milliseconds. All of these milliseconds add up and eventually can lead to a bad user performance. So the scenario three then really is thinking about what are the key tenants. I've misspelled that, I should say T-E-N-E-T-S. What are the key tenants that we have within the enterprise? We've got to support commodity to enterprise level hardware. Security and manageability features are required. We need to store the data in two places at all times. And we need to minimize code modification requirements. The store the data in two places at all times, what's the worst case scenario that we're thinking of there? Is it a single server failure? Do we need to persist that if the whole data center fails? You know, what are we actually dealing with here? What's the worst case scenario that we're dealing with? One of the customers that I'm working with right now, we're actually going through this process now. You know, they gave us their DR documentation. It's like, what's the actual worst case scenario that you're going through? It's important to ask those questions. So the scenarios that we have for the three buckets, we need to source session state information and it needs to not be dependent on a single machine. We need to provide a scale performance of 1.6 as the traffic increases by 6x, and we need to meet the organizational requirements that they have. So I've put them under here. So we have load balancing with no affinity is required. We need to reduce the end user response time for scenario 2, provide a scale factor of 1.6, and reduce access to the database for read-only information. And then in terms of the organizational requirements, the solution must support commodity to enterprise level hardware, security and manageability features are required, we need to store the data in two places at all times, and we need to minimize the code modification. So what are the high level? This is the back of a fag packet, you know, kind of what's my architecture choices. Really, I see kind of three choices here to meet that. I see I could do ASP.NET session state provider. I could do AppFabric and use the session state provider that provides. And I could also use that to store reference and activity data. Or I could use SQL Server to store my data, and I could use the ASP.NET session provider, which I have there. I can cross one of them off the list, first of all, which is the ASP.NET session state provider. That has a dependency on a single machine. If that single machine goes down, I've lost all of the session state. So therefore, we can rule that out good, and that's good if we can rule things out early on. The other two now meet scenario one. For scenario two, it's important actually for me to break out just at a high level what are my options that I have here. So options that I have, I can scale up. If I have a single database, I can put more and more memory in that single server, right? That is one option. I can buy more memory, I can buy more disks, I can, you know, now go up to 256 CPUs with SQL 2008 R2. There is no problem, right? Well, actually there is. There's a lot of choices we need to make. I can scale out the database. Maybe I want to store user 1 here, user 2 here, you know, etc. That's another choice that I have. Or I can go for some type of a caching or a combination of those approaches. Then meeting the organizational requirements, SQL and App Fabric Cache, I've put a star next to SQL. And really, the reason why I've put a star on it is one of the things that they mentioned to us when we were looking at the organization was that SQL Server is hot right now. So one of the key things that we'd have in this case is anything that we can do to take the load off SQL Server is a good thing, right? And if I can take the load off SQL Server with relatively cheap commodity hardware, then that's actually saving the organization money, right? So it's important to bear those things in mind, just as you've heard in a number of the other sessions. So option one, SQL Server then. So scenario one, we can do a load balancing. All of the servers can use the same SQL Server as their session state provider. We can reduce end-user response times. I've put that as a yellow, just because of the load on SQL Server right now and for the reasons that we talked around. Initially, you get the benefits from an implicit cache in the buffer pool, but as your working data set increases, you lose that, right? So I've put that as a yellow right now. It sounds like this customer is getting performance issues. We can store the data in two places at all times. I've put that as a green, even though you may say, why not? Well, the data is stored in a durable fashion, right? And most likely, under the covers, we're using some type of a RAID storage, so the data is actually persisted to two drives, right? And if we want to take it one step further, there are other options that are familiar to all SQL Server customers. You know, we can do storage level replication and a number of other things. We can use database mirroring technology. We have lots of options here, so I'm not concerned around that. Reducing access to the database for read-only information. We're definitely not meeting that requirement here. I think that's obvious to see, right? In terms of the key tenants, does SQL Server meet all of those things? Does it have a security model? Yes. Can we store data in two places at all times? Yes. Can I minimize code modifications? Yes. You know, it's relatively trivial to implement this. And interestingly, the fact that it is relatively trivial to do this approach is actually the reason why a lot of people end up in these challenging situations in the first place, right? It's always easier to follow the line of least resistance. And the line of least resistance is not always the best option. So when I look to App Fabric Cache then, the main thing, I'm not going to go through them all, it meets everything apart from the storing data in two places at all times. And it's a yellow there because it meets it depending on what your definition is of that is. For a named cluster, and we'll talk, for a named cache, and we'll talk about the terminology for App Fabric Cache in a few moments. On a cache level, you can actually enable the high availability feature. And what we do when we actually hash the data and store it under the covers is we ensure that it's stored in two places at all times. But if both of those servers do fail or you restart both of them at the same time, there's some catastrophic event, you have lost that data. So it's important to bear that in mind, right? This is an explicit cache. That means I explicitly need to define what I'm going to put in the cache. And if I want to store that data in a database as well on the back end, that's something right now in the current version of the product that is your job to do and you need to do, you know, or my job to do, or whoever the developer actually is. So as long as we're aware of that and we can accept that, then that's something, you know, for us to consider. So when we looked at it and we looked at the selection summary for this architecture, we really see a couple of benefits for App Fabric Cache. Built for high performance and scale, easily integrating for the session state, I'm going to show you that. And there is simple .NET based APIs. I'm going to show you some of those as well. And the chapter actually goes through both of these scenarios. And it's available as part of Windows Server SKU. Let me be clear on what I mean by available. And I do have a slide on this later. When I mean available, there are two components for the cache. There are the server components. So I have my server, which is my distributed cache. So a cache can be one server, two servers, or more servers. They need to run the server, Windows service, which is the App Fabric Cache service. And then I need my clients, which can actually access the service. The server needs to run on Windows 2008 or Windows 2008 R2. the client, one of the features that they were able to put in as part of the early adopter feedback is that the client can now run and is supported on Windows 2003. So what this means is if you have an existing web application in your organization today and you're hitting some of these challenges, yes, you'll need to have Windows 2008 for the actual service itself, but your clients that are running on Windows 2003 can access that today and actually take advantage of Velocity, which is a good thing, and it's something that we push for internally. It is still a V1 product, so from a risk perspective, so it's hard to find that many people who've done that much with the cache. How many people have downloaded a sample Fabric cache, installed it, gone through a few white papers, etc.? Hands up in this room. So probably about like 20% or something. And I'd say this is within a very strong, user group that we have here with very high level technical skills. Outside of this, normal professionals, we probably have, less than 10% of people have experience with that, and even less have experience with actual real implementations. Can I ask, has anyone actually done a real implementation of the cache? Yeah, okay, one person. I'd love to talk to you afterwards and find out what you've done. So the other risk is that the HA feature, it does support two replicas, but as I said, it is all still held in memory. So what we're going to do now, I'm going to spend some time really, I've decided for this use case that given that the database was hot and given that they had other problems within the organization and given that they wanted to store session state information and primarily read-only, like user interaction type of data, social networking, user feeds, all of these things, that's not necessarily critical to the organization, I've decided that we're going to use OutFabric Cache. Of course, they're still going to use SQL Server as well, and any online company for their critical kind of like information related to payments, it's probably not a good idea to store that information in the cache. Or if you are, it's good to at least implement a write-through. So I just want to make it clear that this is a combination of, but AppFabric Cache is the primary technology here. What I'm going to do is I'm going to walk through at a high level what AppFabric Cache is and should talk through the pattern that we actually have in a bit more detail and actually sort of show you some demos and some of the administration tools and all of those things that are actually provided. Then what I'm going to do is talk more about future scenarios and some of the other aspects of the cache after we've done the demo. As we're going through, there's quite a lot that we're going to cover. I have some 60 slides or something in total. So if you do have questions as we're going through it, please do just ask them throughout. I think that's a better way of doing it. So AppFabric caching is explicit in-memory cache for all kinds of data. We can store CLR objects, XML, binary data within there. We do support reasonably large object sizes within there. However, if you are going to store large objects in the cache, because of the internal workings of it, it is actually better to do your own chunking before you actually put the data into the cache. You will get a better performance overall as you increase the amount of objects that you're storing when you do it in this way. So the clients access the cache as if it was a large single cache. And what this means is if I have 4 servers with 4 gigabytes available, 4 gigabytes of working set for the cache available, that means I have 16 gigabytes of total cache. If I had another server, I now have 20 gigabytes of cache. So the caching clients can be across machines or processes, and the caching layer automatically distributes the data across the various cache nodes. Just really to point out, some of you yesterday saw this slide, AppFabric is released and actually in use today. So by the beginning of August, we'd had over 6,000 downloads. That was for the RTM, which is the released to manufacturing version of the product. We have a really deep engagement internally with at least 30 customers. And we have 9 customers that went into production pre-RTM. One of them I'll talk about a little bit later on is Associated Press. So the first scenario and kind of like the quickest win that you'll get with Velocity is the session state scenario. So we talked earlier how one of the key challenges that a website has is if I use ASP.NET session state provider, if a single machine goes down, then I lose all of that user's session, essentially, and the user has to re-log in, and essentially we need to recreate that session information. If we actually put a caching tier within here, The Velocity team have implemented the custom interface for ASP.NET session state. So the caching, the actual session state information itself can be hosted in the cache. And what this means is I'm no longer tied. I no longer have to do any affinitization for a user by port number or whatever it is that I'm doing using NLB or my other load balancer. So anytime a user logs in, they can log into any of the servers, right? This is certainly a key improvement, and you know, it's one of the most interesting scenarios that we, it's one of the scenarios that customers are most interested in when we talk to them about Velocity. So why use App Fabric caching? I really just wanted to summarize some of the reasons, the things that we think about internally and why we think it's a good fit. So we can share data across applications, session state, and also resource information. It is a distributed cache, so it's not just a local cache. So if server one accesses some type of a catalog information, like a picture for a product that someone buys on Amazon, and on server two someone else logs into that, the call doesn't need to go to the database anymore. It only needs to go to the actual caching tier, which obviously reduces the load on my database and improves my performance. The performance, we're looking at around 28,000 read or write operations per second with, you know, a couple of milliseconds latency. In terms of scalability, like we talked about, that's a key thing. As we add more boxes, you can see we get reasonably close to a linear scale, right? So this is something that you can start small and grow big. High availability, this can protect us from individual web server failure and also from an individual cache server failure. One thing I want to point out is that if you do decide to use the HA feature, you will need Windows Enterprise Edition. So either Windows 2008 Enterprise or Windows 2008 R2 Enterprise Edition in order to use that. Otherwise, it will be the data will only be stored in one place. So proven technology. We have a number of customers that have used it. One of the references that we use the most is actually Associated Press. Associated Press previously had a local caching solution. So what I mean is on each of their individual worker servers, they actually had a local caching service and they maintained access to information that that server had accessed. The problem with that is that as the working set of the data that you're accessing increases, then the local cache actually becomes quite inefficient and you get server 1 and server 2 and server 3 having to go and poll for the news item within the database fairly often. In this case, this is a news application, so it's for sites to publish news content, for people to write news content, so it changes reasonably often. What they found is they found huge improvements when they went to a distributed caching solution over their previous local caching solution. To give you an idea of a scale, they're getting around 15 million hits per day, so this is reasonably big site, right? You know, one of the top sites that we've seen with this. So best yet, you can do this right now if you have Windows Server 2008 or 2008 R2 licenses. You can use your commodity hardware today. It's already shipped. It ships out of band for Windows Server 2008 and Windows Server 2008 R2. And the bonus is that the client APIs can actually be used on Windows 2003. We realized as we went through the life cycle for this technology that many customers, it was a key use case that they wanted to actually, they had existing web applications that were running on Windows 2003 and they wanted to get the benefit of caching for those. So pattern specifics then, so hopefully that kind of sets the scene on what is caching, what is Microsoft's implementation of caching, who's using it today, is the product available, and how does it work at kind of like a very high level. What I'm going to drill into now is here's some of the pattern specifics and what we're looking at in this case. So in this type of an architecture, we have a user, we have, you know, some type of routing device, NLB, or some hardware load balancer, which is routing us to one or more web servers, and then we have a database server. What we've done is we've implemented a caching tier, so caching becomes the fourth tier in the typical three tier application, you know, the presentation application and database. We now, you know, the common phrase is caching is now our fourth tier that we have. You could install that on a, you know, on the servers itself if you wanted to, but typically we recommend that you have a separate dedicated caching tier that you can manage and administrate. So in terms of installing this, where do I get this from before we jump into the actual virtual machine that I have? This comes and this is available today when you download and install App Fabric. App Fabric is the name is still, I find, associated in people's mind with the previous code name Dublin, right? Which was the host that we provide for WCF and WF. A decision was made to ship App Fabric the Velocity, which was the code name for the caching component we see as part of App Fabric, because those two technologies fit well together. And we see that the reason behind that decision is that we see, applications need a number of services which are provided by a host. One of those is workflow, another one of those is connectivity through WCF, and the third one now that we provide is caching. You'll see us continue this theme over the number of releases, and you'll see us actually add more services into that host that we provide, so it becomes a richer host and it provides more capabilities for you so that you can use this within your application. If you install App Fabric, you'll see there is the caching services and the cache client that you can select. The tool, the administration tool of choice that we have today is primarily PowerShell. So you can see here, I'm doing a list to get, this is on Rama's machine. We're looking at what are all of the commands that are available for us to manage the cache. So there is the get cache config, the get cache host, restart cache host, etc., etc., etc. The PowerShell commandlets are actually reasonably easy to use once you start using them. I was actually quite surprised myself at how easy and how intuitive it was, but there is no, tooling and etc. associated with it. All of the investment in this release has been made in really making sure that our caching solution scales and making the underlying platform stable. So this is just some more screenshots just to give you an idea of the administration interface and how we expect users to actually look at it. Monitoring the cache. If you have, you want to look at a single node, you can use get cache statistics and then the name of the cache. The name of the cache is kind of like, think of it like an application in BizTalk Server 2006, 2006 R2, 2009, 2010, the concept that we introduced there. It's a container that we can use to store an amount of information. And the reason why we have this concept of a named cache is that we can apply policy information for security, etc. So we can apply security and management information to a named cache. So you can see here that the size of the cache is 5184. The item count is 7, the region count is 7. Region is if we want to group a set of data together so that when I request the data from the cache, rather than having to make 5 calls, which all have the overhead of making the call, I can just make a single call to a region. So I may want to get all of the, think about a site, think about querying for, I want to look for a laptop. They may want to put all of the laptops by Acer or by HP or by Dell or by another manufacturer in a separate region, for instance, if it's catalog information. That means that when the developer's doing the call, they only need to call that specific region. So you can see here that we have a request count of 59 and a miss count of 7. In the demo earlier, and later that you'll see that the goal is that we want the request count to increase and we want our miss count to be very low. And we want that to maintain and that pattern to continue as we actually increase the working set that we have in the cache. Obviously, this is not, super user-friendly to do. So what the App Fabric cache team actually did is they actually shipped a set of perfmon counters. And the perfmon counters, I'll show you them later, actually allow you to the perfmon counters that we provide actually allow you to monitor at a kind of overall cluster level, an individual host level, and an actual named cache level. This is really useful, and while I've been working with the product, I've already found it useful to actually troubleshoot issues, understand the efficiency of my cache. So I would encourage you to spend some time and actually look, as well as looking at the API and all of those things that's provided, actually look at some of the administration concepts and the perfmon in particular that we provide. So before we get into the demo then, what are the things that I need to change in my application? If you want to use the client, you need to reference 4 client DLLs which are installed. When you install the cache client feature, we put 4 cache client DLLs on your local server and we gag them. From any application like your ASP.NET web application, if you want to make a use of App Fabric, then you need to add references to the client and to the core DLL in order to use that. Typically what we advise is we advise people to make a wrapper class that encapsulates all of the logic that they're using when they're accessing the cache and use those references there. There are some code changes and also sets because this is an explicit cache. So apart from the session state, you don't get anything else for free. You have to actually put that logic into your code. So that does require changes. So this is just showing you the references that you need to add. So in terms of the session state modification, I just wanted to highlight this on the slide so that if anyone downloads the deck, they can see that. You can see that the session state mode that we specify in the web.config for the application is custom. We need to specify the data cache session provider. In order that we can get that, we need to reference these DLLs somewhere in our web or app.config. And we need to specify the provider that we're using. So this is the Velocity session state provider. Other things that you can specify there are other properties for the data cache client, the request timeout, the channel open timeout, etc., etc., the cache port that we're using, and here the actual host name. So this is quite important. This is the actual name of the cache server that we're actually connecting to, and this is the port on which we're connecting to. And you can see here, this is obviously a super secure machine. We have security properties none and protection level none. So security is an optional setting. By default, it is on now in the final version of the product. Obviously, on developer machine, you may wish to turn it off, so that is something that you can do. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you a demo now. It'll be a live demo just to convince my colleagues here, and so hopefully it passes the test. So we have a site which has a tic-tac-toe. We're using the Velocity session state provider so that when we log out and disconnect, when we log back in, hopefully it'll have all the information about the game that I have. And then what we're also going to do is show you some of the logic, how we've encapsulated some of the get and the put calls that we've done for the API. Does anyone have any questions so far? No?
I have a question.
Okay. Okay.
Is the spread across multiple caching servers? Is that done on the server side? And which one? Because that pointed out one specific.
So in this case, we just had a single server. We can, when we do multiple ones, you can specify the cluster name. I need to check for you in terms of is that done on NLB type level or that? I will follow up afterwards and get back to you on that question. Okay? Anything else? Okay, so what I'll do, as I was going, when I first started, when we started the book and we started looking at AppFabric Cache and I started working with Rama a lot, who'd been spending a lot of time on it, there's quite a number of steps that you need to follow. So what I've done is I put a little script together and I'll share that, with the slides that we have, because there's not really single source. When we look at the cache, the way that we administer it is through PowerShell. So if we look at some of the things that we can do. So let me just shut down my cache. So if I stop the cache cluster, we don't have anything running right now. So you can see here, I have a host name, demo 2008. I have the cache port, which is 22233. I have the service name, which is AppFabric Caching Service, and the service status is down. If you look within services, MSC, you will see similar service that reflects those details. Things that I may want to do before I start the cluster up, I may want to set the cache cluster security. So I can do set cache cluster security none. So I can specify protection level none. And because I've already got that specified, you can see that no configuration will be updated. If I'm going to use the cache, I need to actually grant myself permission to it. So if I want to grant an account permission, I need to grant the cache allowed client account, and I need to specify either the local machine account or the Active Directory account that I actually have in order that they can actually log on. Obviously, if you've disabled security, then it doesn't really matter. But if you had the security still enabled, this is an important thing. And these are like the common things that trip people up. If we look at the allowed clients that we have, okay, you can see that, you know, just that single user has permission. So over time, you know, if I was going on site and troubleshooting, these are probably the first few things that I'd actually want to look at, right? You know, do you have security enabled? Security is really important to you. Well, you have it set to none. Okay, are you protecting this with like IPsec or some VPN or something? Obviously, we need to do that, especially when people start to store more and more sensitive data within there. To start the cluster, we do start cache cluster. And what that does is start the cluster host that we have, and that will start all the hosts which are part of that specific cache cluster that we have. So you can see in this case we have this single host name. The host name concept will be familiar for all of you people who have done BizTalk. So again, this is an example where the familiarity that we all have with BizTalk actually helps us with some of this new technology because we're familiar with these concepts. So we've started the cache cluster. If we want to make a cache, which is our new cache, I can do new cache, and then let's call it test cache. And the cache names are all case sensitive. So that has now actually been created. And I can actually do a get cache. And what I've actually done when I've run through this and prepared this demo, I've actually created a session cache, a headline news cache, and a games history cache, which we'll actually use in the demo I show you a little bit later. If I do a get cache, what that does is it gets all of the caches that I actually have on the server right now. There is actually a default cache. I advise that you probably don't use it. The cache is a management level. You can also use it as an application boundary. You know, you don't really want multiple applications there in the same cache, right? So I would really strongly advise that you didn't use that feature. So let's remove that cache that we just created earlier. Test cache and make sure we type it in. Okay, and if we do a get cache, we'll see now that we have less of them, right? So that's all very nice and good, but what were we actually doing? So if I look on here, we have a website, and if I just open a new tab, and if I go to localhost login.aspx, it works, which is good, fingers crossed, eh? And if I log in as Stockholm, and we have really strong authentication here, so we have the same username and password. And if I log in, I And if I start playing this game, probably most of you have remembered this, right? There is a sequence that you can use that always wins. I can't remember it now, though. But if I start playing this, right, and then if I actually disconnect and log back in as Stockholm, what you can see is it's actually still there. In fact, if I log in as Richard, I think I made a session for him earlier, and he's losing, obviously. Oh, no, he's not. He hasn't played. Let's make him lose. So now if I actually stop the cache, so I've logged in as Richard, let me disconnect and let me log back in. Right? And if we actually have a look in the commandlet, and if we do a get cache statistics and we do session cache, we know that we need to access the session cache every time we log in. What we'll actually see is that we've had a request count of 43 and a miss count of 1, right? So after we've had to populate the cache, we don't need to go there anymore. The reason why you don't see more, so if I log out, so just remember those numbers, so 43 and 1, if I disconnect and log in as Richard again, you can see that we've gone back, so we should have an increase here. Okay, so you can see we had to do a number of calls to the cache. One thing to point out is that at the moment, the way that the session state provider is implemented is if you need to get data from the session state, we actually need to get all of the session state information every time we go to the cache. Obviously, as we go forward in the future, that will be something that we look to change and we'll make it more specific, but that will be in future release. In V1 right now, we have to get all of the session state information every time you do the access. If I stop the cache, so let's stop the cache. I just want to illustrate the point. Okay. And let's start the cache back up. And then if we do a get cache statistics now, we should expect that we'll see nothing in there, right? So if we do get cache statistics, it's going to give me about 100 things here. And it was session state get cache statistics. Okay, you can see that there's actually nothing in the cache. So now I'm going to get some nasty, horrible errors. You can see, like, the thing is broken, so we need to add in some specific error handling logic here. The point is here that if we had if we had multiple nodes in our App Fabric cache cluster, then we wouldn't have that issue because the data would be stored in two places, but you still are storing data in memory, right? So if the cache does go down and you start again, you do lose all of that information. So I just want to make that really clear to you guys. However, you still get the benefits, and if you're using ASP.NET, session state provider, you're in the same position, right? So let me just do a quick IIS reset, just to get rid of any connections that I have. And what I'm going to do now is we're going to actually look at some of the perfmon counters that it has, and then we're going to look at some of the code. So let me just delete this and delete this. So if I go to add counters, as long as the cache service is up, the same as with BizTalk, App Fabric Cache actually publishes a number of counters. So when I go down here, you'll see that we have the App Fabric Cache, the host, and the secondary host. So the cache level is really if I want to look at what's the performance, what's the request count, what's the miss count, etc., of the individual named cache that I'm looking at. The host level is really what's the performance of that specific host. And really the secondary counters is how is the replication going? Are there any errors with that, right? So in a HA scenario where you had multiple nodes, am I not actually sending the data correctly when I actually split it up and duplicate it in two places? So for our scenario, we have a session cache. So let's actually look at the actual session cache information. So if I expand this, and let's just add all of these counters. Okay, I think I actually need to log in first of all to create, to prime the cache. So if I log in as Ewan and Ewan, and I cancel this, and I just go back to add again. Okay, and this is not going to work again, but let's cross our fingers. Okay, cool. So it worked. So now, if I go to App Fabric Cache, and we could look at the host counters, but in this case, let's look at the session state counters, and you can see that I have the actual, because I have a named cache, and because I've warmed this cache up, and I've actually added objects to it when I've logged in, you'll see that that session cache object actually becomes available under this perfmon object. So what you can see here is that total cache misses have been 2, the total client requests have been 8. If I disconnect and log in again, and go back to perfmon, you can see that that's increased to 16. And if I log in as Richard, or as Stephen this time, you can see that it's increased now, it's 24. So what are we doing underneath the covers? And let's have a look at more of a realistic scenario. So what I'm going to do, we have a test client here, which is basically going to log in, and it's going to do a number of requests, a couple of hundred iterations. And it's basically going to call the login page. You can see here I've passed in the URL that we have. We're going to wait for the response, call the page, do a bunch of things, and then log out. So let's just run this. Should have come up. Okay, so you can see each of those dots. Now, that was simulating a lot of user load on the actual site. What's actually happened, you can see that the total client request is 124, but if you look at the total cache misses, we've got 102. And the cache miss percentage is 82. If I logged in again, it would be much less. But here, what we're trying to illustrate is the first time that you log in, you'll actually miss the cache. The second time you log back in, because we have to actually create the item, the second time you actually log in, we'll actually retrieve the data from the actual cache itself. So monitoring these requests is really important. Sorry, monitoring these perfmon counters is actually really important, because it actually can actually point out issues either with your infrastructure or with the actual code that you have deployed. If I go back, so how did we actually configure the application to actually use the cache? So the first thing is, in the web.config, you can see we have a section name, data cache client, and we press in a reference to the App Fabric client assemblies. We then specify the session state mode equals custom, and you can see that we're saying the data cache session store provider. And then this is my machine, demo 2008, and this is the cache port that I have. And you can see I'm not interested in security on this demo machine, so I've turned both of those things off. Obviously, if you had security enabled, you would need to make sure, just like you do with BizTalk server when you have an isolated host, that the user for that application pool actually had permission and was one of the accounts that we'd actually granted early on into the actual allowed users for the Velocity cache. Options that you can do then, so that's kind of like the what do I get for free. Now let's look at how do I actually use a cache within my application, how do I make use of it, what can I do with it, those type of things. It is relatively simple to actually do it. It's basically a get and a put. There are some more options if you want to use some type of a locking. We have two types of locking that we cover, which I'm going to talk about later. But really, it's a get in a put scenario. But it is explicit in that you need to do those things yourself, right? And if you do a get and the cash returns a failure and says that we haven't actually got that item in the cash, you actually need to do the put yourself. So it's explicit in that sense. So you can see here, I've got my data cache object, the game's history. We've got a news cache name, headlines news cache. We define a bunch of things. I do my setup. And if we actually look at some of the methods that we have, so if we look at update game's history, so this is what we're using when a user logs out, we can say that we have game's history DC, which is the data cache that we've specified earlier, and we're putting in there a string and an object that we actually defined earlier. And you can see that what Rama, the approach that Rama actually took when he did this sample, was to actually encapsulate all of the caching logic into its own actual separate class, right? And this is the pattern that we recommend, and this is what he recommends and our team recommends when we're working with customers. So we have like an update game history, the news cache name, the get news feed. So you can see here that we're using the get, and we're specifying what we want, the name of the cache. So we're saying get the items from the cache, and the cache name is headlines, right? So reasonably straightforward in order to do that. Okay. Let me go back. Okay, so we've run the game now. So how does this work? And what else can we do with caching, right? Those are the questions that I'm asking if I'm seeing a presentation like this. So what I'm going to do is take you on, cover some of the other scenarios that we have, cover some of the considerations that we have when we use caching, and really talk about some of the future scenarios that we actually have. So I wanted to talk about the hierarchy that we have with a cache. As with any new server technology from Microsoft, there's new acronyms to remember or new concepts to remember. And App Fabric Cache is no different. We have a machine. We have a cache host, named caches. So the cache host is the member of the cache cluster. We have a named cache, which is our bucket that we use to put things in. We have a region, which is where if we want to do like a bulk get or a bulk put, and we can get items by a region, and within a region we have cache items. So you can see by default we have single cache host, we have a cluster, we have it containing one cache host with a default named cache, a default region, and then no items, and the items are the objects that we put in there. So the host, as it says there, the physical process is hosting App Fabric, and the named caches can span across machines, right? It's a distributed cache. So the types of data, this is really important because this becomes a key consideration when you're using caching. What are the types of data that I can add and what are the top scenarios? And some of them are easier to do than other. So the reference data is really, I have a primary read-only scenario. So I want to access, so if someone logs into a site, I want to show them images from the catalogue of items that I actually sell. I'm a toy store, I'm an electronics store, I'm Costco.com. In fact, no one knows Costco here, right? I'm talking to American audience. So Costco is a huge electrical outlet. If they want to sell things online, they might want to have images of the TVs, of the videos, of all of those things, right? We refer to that as reference data or catalog data. When we think of activity data tends to be associated with a single user, and it tends to be read and write information, but not shared. When we say not shared, it can be shared across multiple machines because a user can log on to more than one machine, but it's not shared between users. If I log into a site, I'm hoping that my information is not shared with someone else who logs in, like Richard or someone like that. I don't know what he might do with it. If we have resource information, this is something where it's read and write and it's shared, and this becomes the most complex to deal with. So the best example of this to think of is seats on a plane. If we're all going to go from Stockholm to US, or if me, Richard and Stephen are going to book a flight from the US to come to Stockholm, there may be only two seats left on the plane, right? And we may need to book those, and multiple applications that the vendors are using to book, the travel agents are using to book our tickets, may need access to that same information. So that would be an example of resource information that could be stored in Velocity. Sorry, in App Fabric Cache. So when we look at caching requirements, things that we need to do then, how do we look to architect a solution using this, and how do we look to put a solution actually together? We need to actually classify the data. So we classify it as reference, activity, and resource data. We need to examine the requirements. So performance, how much throughput and latency do we need? How much consistency? Can we tolerate machine failure? Can we tolerate a loss of the data of some of it or a portion of it? Is the data evictable? We can have eviction policies within App Fabric Cache as well, and I'll talk more about them later. Is there any secure data? Do I need to have a separate named cache that has a very specific security policy associated with it? That's an option that I have. What's the availability that I have? Do I need to have Windows Enterprise Edition so that it can survive a node failure? If I want it to survive cluster failure, right now with the current version of the technology, that's something that I'm going to have to do myself. I'm going to have to store the data in two caches, right? Is that an option I want to consider, right? All of these are things that are important to consider up front. So reference data in terms of performance, if the catalog doesn't change that often, so if we're talking about images of a TV, Panasonic or Sony or Samsung or all of those people, they release new versions of a TV, you know, of TVs once a month, once a quarter, you know, it's quite infrequent. It's not going to change every day, every minute, every week, every hour. So one option that we have, as well as having the distributed cache concept, is that on the actual client itself, we can have this concept of a local cache. So we can actually cache that data. We actually can actually configure that. So if we look here, we're going to put an object, which is K2V2. We're going to put that in the cache, and these are our cache servers. You can see that the object gets stored here. And we send a response back and acknowledge that. Now, if this client is also running App Fabric caching client use and it does the get, it will go to a local cache first of all. It will see that it doesn't have the object. And then when it doesn't see that, it will go to the caching node 2 by looking at the routing table, and it will actually populate its own local cache. The next time that we need to do a get K2, you can see that we only have to go to the local cache server. So in this scenario, we can actually get the benefits of a distributed cache, but also get the benefits of a local cache as well. And this is specifically for reference data. It's a scenario you should look at. So configuring local cache then, how do I go about doing that? You add these sections to your app config or web.config file. So local cache enabled is true. There are two types of sync options that you can have. So the sync is really, how do I get the data out of here? We can have a timeout-based notification where we'll start to evict stuff on a timeout level, or we can have a notification-based. Here, the object count, once we go beyond this number of objects in the local cache, and by default it's 100,000, we'll decrease and we'll get evict 20% of the objects after this point. And the time to live value is the time to live after which time we'll put this object and say it's okay to evict it. So in this case, after 300 seconds or after 5 minutes, we're saying that we can get rid of this item, right? That may or may not be appropriate for your scenario, right? Those of you that have dealt with throttling thresholds and BizTalk and dehydration settings and all of those things, I've done that lots of times over, you know, with customers that I've worked with, you'll be familiar that these type of parameters are something that needs to be tuned to the specific requirements of the customer, and that's really why I'm bringing them up today. If I want to do a notification, I can actually subscribe in code to actually a notification, and I can do that on a couple of different levels. I can do a cache level callback, I can do a region level callback, or I can do an item level callback. And that really, again, depends on what you want. You may care if anything in the cache changes, if anything in the region changes, or if any specific item changes, right? So for instance, if any update to pricing information is done, and that's my region, I probably want to get that information and display it to the users, right? I don't want to give them the wrong prices. Doing cache level callback might be quite expensive. You're probably going to get a lot of updates on your application, but it's something to consider, and it may be appropriate for some scenarios. If you, in that scenario where you're doing a cache level callback, I would consider whether a region level callback is more appropriate. Segmenting your data by caches can be quite expensive administratively, right? Regions might be a better approach. So when we look at session card integration, we've covered this scenario already, and we specify the custom's session state mode and the session store provider, and specify the app fabric session store provider here, and that's all you really need to do. And the session state is now stored in app fabric cache. So you can actually scale your session store dynamically by adding multiple servers to the cache cluster. Okay, so in terms of how does the API work then, you saw some of it. We create a cache factory. We can create an instance of the cache factory that specifies the local cache to true. So there are a number of different constructors which are available. And now we can get a named cache from the actual factory. So in this case, we're getting the name catalog cache. And just please bear in mind that it is case sensitive. So it's important to remember that. Once we've actually got that, so you can see we've got catalog, we can call get and puts. So put toy 101 into the cache, and now I want to get toy 101, and that's the key value that I use to get the item. So local cache settings that we have in the app config, we specify the host name and the cache port, and whether local cache is enabled is true, and we can specify any security settings. Or we can do all of these things via code, right? So those of you that have worked with WCF, it's a similar concept there, right? In terms of availability then, how does that work? Basically, the way that it works, if we need to store an object, so we need to store K2, we have a routing table which is based on the name of the cache and the region that it goes into. We put the item in the first node, here in this case cache 2, and then we put the item in the cache 1 server, which is part of our cache cluster. One question that I've seen, and I've had a lot of people ask me, is what's the scenario for HA right now between sites? The scenario right now is that you use dark fiber and you actually have replication. So you have like LAN-based connectivity over the dark fiber between the different cache clusters. Right now for caching, they don't see it as a scenario where you're going to want to have geographically disparate, you know, cluster available for caching, right? It doesn't make sense because it's going to be hard to do the timeouts and all of those things, right? What this does mean is that if you have more than two machines, if you have two machines in your cache cluster and you have one in data center 1 and one in data center 2 and you have dark fiber going between them and you enable HA, you know that the data is going to be on server 1 and then the other copy of it is going to be on server 2. So if the data center fails, then I'm okay, or if the power goes down in that rack. If you have four servers today, how it stands in version 1, and you have two in one data center and two in another, then both copies of the data could be on the servers in data center 1, or both copies could be in data center 2, right? That's obviously something that they're looking at internally and something that will be addressed, but I want to make you aware of these gotchas, you know, today. Okay. And you can see that all of this is done before the notification is sent back to the client and that call completes. So you can see here that the next time we do the get, we go to cache 2 and we get it, and we can get it from either of these copies. So failover then, how does that work? So that box goes down. The partition manager actually implements some logic and it'll immediately start copying the data across to box number 3. K2 and V2 will get moved across to box number 3. And that will become the secondary now. And when we do the routing table, when we get K3, you can see that it's accessed here. So what will actually happen is if you do a graceful shutdown of a velocity of an app fabric service, sorry, I keep saying the word velocity. If you do a graceful shutdown, all of this process actually happens for you. If you pull the plug on the actual service itself, so if you kill the process, this will happen gradually. They did tests internally where they had like a large number of cluster nodes, so they had 5, and they went all the way down from 5 down to 1. And if you do the graceful shutdown, it does work successfully, so the data will get migrated. So that's something interesting and something to be aware of. Okay. we've done. So now we need to get the access. We can't access it from that box. So now we can access it either from box number 3 or box number 1. And internally, our fabric takes care of those things, right? So there are two types of locking that we have available. So there is an optimistic locking and there is a pessimistic locking. On the optimistic locking, when you do a get, you get the version of it. If we want to update that version, if we do the put, because this guy does the put first, this guy is going to succeed and this guy is going to actually fail, right? So this is where you have a high level of concurrency, but you don't expect that there'll be that many puts on the same row or the same item in the cache. So you can see here, two clients access the same item, both update the item, but the second client gets in first. So the first client now needs to explicitly handle that scenario in their code. So their client tries the put, it can't actually do it, so we need to explicitly call that out and handle that. The second scenario is more of a pessimistic locking scenario. So this is where I want to get an object. Instead of making the get call, I do a get and lock. The get and lock gets the lock handle. The object is marked in the cache that there's a lockout on it. The client 2 tries to do the get and lock. The get and lock on this same item fails. Client 3 tries to get it. The regular get succeeds. It's only the get and lock which fails. And really, this allows you to coordinate when you want to update an object, right? So if you have this type of concurrency, and say, for instance, you were updating like a payment information or something that's really important to your organization, where you can't have this scenario where it's kind of like the first one to finish wins, this is the other option that the Velocity API provides for you today. So in terms of tracking changes, I talked about this briefly before. You can either do a cache level callback, a region level callback, or a key level callback for a specific item that we have in the cache. So there are a number of options available to you. The security model is based on domain and local account, and we also only authorized servers can join the cluster. So if you do turn off the cache security, like I said earlier, make sure that you either use firewalls, IPsec or VLANs, or it's a developer box and you just don't really care about it. So in terms of administration and monitoring, like most Microsoft products now, there is ETW Trace available for it. But the most useful features that I found through working Velocity are actually the PowerShell commandlets and the actual PerfMon integration that it has. In terms of eviction then, so objects in the name cache have a lifespan. You can expire items periodically or per partition. You can evict expired items and non-expired items. The methodology that we actually use is a least recently used algorithm. So we'll look at when was the last time that the object was actually accessed and used within the cache, when was the get or the put called on it. It can be turned off. We also automatically have some memory pressure. So those of you that are familiar with BizTalk, it's kind of like a throttling mechanism. When we start to detect that there's a pressure within the App Fabric cache cluster, we'll actually start to actually flush some of the items out of the cache, starting with like 10% and going upwards from there. So a lot of the concepts that you see within BizTalk and how BizTalk manages like processor utilization and how it manages other contention on resources like memory, as you'll see those similar kind of concepts in App Fabric cache. So in terms of deployment then, you enable the cache server role, you have your caching tier, we have our configuration store. The configuration store can either be file-based store or it can be a database store. Those are two options that you have. So it can either be XML file-based and you have to create a share on the first Velocity, the first App Fabric cache server, or you can store it within a SQL database. Those are real two different options for you. Any app.config or web.config file needs this this cache host name and the port that you're using. The caching API, I've covered most of this. I think this was supposed to be hidden. So simple get and put. We can do a region get and put as well. Sorry.
Yeah, if you have the file share option, what does that do for your availability?
So the question is, if you go for the file share option, which stores all the cluster configuration.
Yeah, if you do that on like a first cache instance, then if that one dies, then you...
Yeah, there's no configuration. As far as I know, there's no configuration available. So most of the time, the file-based option, the XML-based option, is really just for developer, you know, machines. So most of the time, yes, you would use SQL Server and you would store your configuration there, right? It's like the BizTalk management database. So yeah, thank you for pointing that out, Alan. So I just wanted to highlight one thing. You can do the get and the put on the individual items. So we do the toy catalog.get toy 101. We can actually create a region, which is a toy region. So you can imagine creating a region for like electrical products or my TVs or something like that. We put a lot of items in this toy region and then we get the item from the toy region, right? Or we can get all of the objects from that specific region, right? So those are the options that we have. We can also do tagging the items. So we can do a bulk get if we want, right? So here, from the same or from a different client, we can get any matching tag, toy region, and then the hot item, right? Okay. This one here. I'm going to skip these last few slides because I've talked through most of them. Okay, so future scenarios then. What are the things that we cover in the future and what are the scenarios that they're looking at, right? So really what I covered today was where we have caching on-premise, right? So we have Windows Server App Fabric that you can download today and is available and is in production with a number of customers, and we have case studies live with it. What are the scenarios that the team are looking at in the future? Those of you that saw the PDC video last year will have seen some of these slides. Basically, the vision is that the App Fabric caching capability will be available the same on-premise and off-premise. So that really opens us up to a number of different scenarios, right? So when we have the data on SQL Azure and we have the application on the local site, you can see that we have our caching service, which actually does the calls to SQL Azure. And the application, when it does the calls, most of the time is getting the data from the local caching service, right? Only when we have a miscount, we actually need to go to SQL Azure. So this handles this scenario. The next scenario that we look at is, what about when the whole application is on Windows Azure, right? So in this case, we have the application on Windows Azure, we have a web role. In the future, we would have an App Fabric caching on Windows Azure, a caching worker role, and then we would have the data on SQL Azure. Well, some people may say, why would I need caching when I'm doing everything in the cloud anyway? Obviously, the machines that physically store the data and the actual application servers are separate, and they're separated by switches. They may be in separate buildings. You know, it depends on the layout of the particular machines that you get when you create the roles. Having the caching service means that we're accessing the machine just over a simple network call, or we could even run it, you know, on the same machine. So we are going to get some performance improvement. And there have been tests that they've done and prototypes that have shown this. The next thing is really if we have Windows Azure and the data on premises. So this is really the scenario that we've talked about today, right? So this will continue to be an important scenario for us. So you can see previously here we had SQL Azure, we had the web role, and we had the caching role. In this scenario, we've got on-premise SQL Server, SQL 2008 R2, or a future version. We've got the on-fabric, app-fabric caching, and then we've got the clients. This scenario is going to continue to be important to us. So key takeaways then that I wanted to take away from this. So app-fabric caching, what is it? It's a distributed memory cache. Why would I need it? It can help your app scale, perform, and it is fault tolerant to a degree, right? Obviously, some of the limitations I showed you, specifically if the whole cache goes down, so if all of the nodes in the cache cluster actually go down, you could lose data. If you have a cache cluster with four nodes in it and you lose two of the nodes in the cache, you could lose data as well. And the other issue, so you need to be aware of those things and make sure that when you're architecting a solution, you bear that in mind. So things that you can get today, we have the ASP.NET session state, so this avoids the sticky routing scenarios. You can explicitly call the cache API within your app. And then the roadmap going forward covers web, enterprise, and cloud scenarios. So V1 is already shipped. The next version of it will be expected sometime next year, calendar year 2011. And basically, as you've seen, I hope you've seen the future scenarios that the team is looking at, the on-premise scenario and also having access to these capabilities in the cloud. So thank you very much. Does anyone have any questions? So I think the question was, if I access data in the local cache versus on the distributed cache, what's the difference, right? And why would I do that? So local cache option is there if you're accessing catalog information. And so let's break the question into two parts. Why would I use local cache? And then what's the performance improvement? What's the performance improvement or the performance cost of going to the distributed cache, right? The local cache is there for a scenario where we have data that doesn't change that often, right? And we want to cache it locally and we'll have multiple servers accessing the same data. So if we have like catalog information, that's a core scenario there, right? We have picture of a TV, you know, pricing information, those type of things. Multiple servers are going to need to access it. And then we have policies that we can provide for eviction and all of those things, right? So the benefit there is that we only need to go in memory, right? In memory access is, you know, in order of magnitude microseconds. Going across the network and going to the distributed cache is going to be milliseconds, right? I haven't done the specific testing on App Fabric cache myself. The figures that I'm quoting are the figures that the team actually provided me. But it definitely is probably order of magnitude or thereabouts, you know, difference. Why would I have distributed cache versus a local cache? If I have a single distributed cache, I only need to populate that cache once, right? So if I need to go to the database and I put on server, if I have server 1, 2, 3, and 4, cache server 1, 2, 3, and 4 in a single database. In the local caching scenario, you wouldn't have this caching tier, right? So server 1 has its own local cache and it would go to the database and it would do that call and it would incur all of the overhead that that has and it would put load on SQL server. SQL may have to go get that data page for if it doesn't have it in the buffer pool. It may need to go get it from disk, which may take, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 milliseconds, however long it actually takes, depending on how much data you're actually getting. It actually gets worse because if you're talking about large information, something like a binary object, then we may need to go look at an internal B-tree structure that we have to get all of the pages for that. We may need to log some of that information. It becomes quite complicated, right? Then we need to populate that local cache on the individual application server. A few milliseconds later or a few seconds later, local application server number 2 comes and it only has a local cache enabled and it needs to do the same operation, right? Whereas with the actual distributed cache concept, I can grow that distributed cache to be a similar size or at least a representative size as the working set that I have. So if I have a working set of 10 gigabytes, I can have a couple of servers that actually have 10 gigabytes of memory available or, you know, etc. So the call only needs to go to the database once in order to actually populate the object. So that's the reason for kind of like having the local cache and having the distributed cache. Does that make sense?